The information and opinions presented in this ARC Energy Ideas podcast are provided for informational purposes only and are subject to the disclaimer link in the show notes.
This is the ARC Energy Ideas podcast with Peter Terzakian and Jackie Forrest, exploring trends that influence the energy business.
Welcome to the ARC Energy Ideas podcast. I'm Jackie Forrest.
And I'm Peter Terzakian. Welcome back. So we have another special guest today that I know our audience is really going to enjoy. But before we get to our special guest, I'd like to just sort of give you a little bit of a preamble about what we're going to talk about, bigger context in terms of trying to achieve net zero by 2050, for example. You know, a large part of the emissions reductions is from energy usage reductions. In other words, energy efficiency, conservation, and so on. And energy efficiency is about a third of the wedge to get us to net zero by 2050. In the mobility market, that energy efficiency can be achieved by using more fuel-efficient vehicles, going to electric vehicles, but it can also be achieved by improving traffic flow. And that reminds me of one of my EnergyFile vignettes, which we'll post from my EnergyFile collection. It's an advertisement from 1935 that speaks to traffic congestions. And traffic congestion, actually, in 1935, the ad says, 4 out of every 5 miles you drive are stop and go. It can take twice the gasoline to stop and go as it does to keep going. Well, this sort of gives us a sense of how parasitic to efficiency traffic congestion is. You know, the frustrations of decelerating to the red light and then accelerating again. But I think we can agree things have gotten a lot worse since 1935, even though I don't know how many of us were here in 1935, but certainly congestion is worse. It's even worse now with people not taking public transit as they try and avoid the congestion of COVID-19. On things like subways and so on. But can we imagine a better traffic flow in the future? Well, there's been a lot of talk these days about self-driving cars and trucks following optimized routes, and they're pitched as part of a better solution. Certainly, if an algorithm can pick a better route to go to avoid that type of congestion that results in such parasitic energy losses, well, that's a good thing. I certainly would welcome it. And the ultimate, of course, is an algorithmic chauffeur that drives us along, and we don't even have to be touching the steering wheel with our hands. Companies like Tesla, Uber, Waymo, formerly of Google, have all been champions of this sorts of things. Well, our special guest today is no stranger to some of our audience, certainly no stranger to our audience that was with us at our forum back in 2017 at Heritage Park. He's Larry Burns, and he's a business advisor on mobility, logistics, manufacturing, energy, and innovation. And those of you who are with us in 2017 know he gave an amazing presentation on the state of self-driving vehicles and mobility and all the cool things that we can expect in the future. That was 4 years ago. We're inviting Larry back to hear about the current state of the future, if I can put it that way. Welcome back, Larry Burns.
Thank you very much, Peter, and also Jackie. It's really great connecting again. It's hard to believe it's been 4 years since that wonderful trip I had and met you in person, but I'm really excited to speak with you again.
Good. Well, for the benefit of our audience, and give a little bit of background about yourself and how you came to be an expert in mobility and autonomous vehicles.
I'd be happy to do that. I had a long career at General Motors. I educated myself as a mechanical engineer, and then went on in graduate school and studied public policy and ultimately civil engineering. My first part of my GM career was in research, studying really production systems and logistics before supply chain was even a popular word. And then I moved into the operating side of GM. And by the middle 90s, I became a senior executive. And ultimately in 1998, I was named head of research and development and planning worldwide for General Motors, which was a wonderful job. And unfortunately, GM proved to be a not-for-profit company, and we went bankrupt in 2009. I moved on to become an advisor to a number of different companies. I also was a professor of engineering practice for 5 years at University of Michigan, and I led a research program at Columbia University on sustainable mobility, which was out of the Earth Institute. I've advised companies like Hess, which is an energy company in the United States, Waymo, which was Google's self-driving cars, Allstate. One of my current clients right now is Goodyear tire manufacturer, and a real estate developer called Kitson & Partners. And then I also just joined the board of a major telematics company that's going public called Wejo, W-E-J-O. And Wejo is actually gathering data from 11 million cars every day in the U.S. and Europe, very, very detailed data, doing that in protecting privacy. But that telematics data is going to really be an important part of the future. So that's what I've been doing.
That's a great introduction, Larry. Yeah, I know the telematics is just a fascinating area. And definitely when we think about cars on the road as a mesh of information that can be optimized, it's really exciting. And maybe we'll talk about that here in a couple minutes. But let's just go back and think about autonomy, autonomous driving. Of course, there's the ultimate, which is get into the vehicle, take a nap, and then wake up whenever you arrive. You know, it's like fully autonomous world versus advanced driving systems or advanced driver assistance systems, otherwise known as ADAS. Can you give us sort of a sense of what advanced driver assistance are today and the state of the union?
I'm glad you framed it that way, Peter, because I think the real technical people in this field of autonomous driving maybe could be accused of making it a little bit harder to understand for everyday people than it needs to be. In my mind, simplistically, I see three kinds of driving. There's human driving, that's with no assist at all, and we're way beyond that because anyone who drives with anti-lock braking or electronic stability control or even with an automatic transmission, they have some kind of an intelligent assist. So now we have this next category of driving, which is a human that has an assist. And there's advanced assist called lane keeping and forward collision warning and emergency braking and full speed adaptive cruise control. And all of these are things that reduce driver workload, but also promise to make driving safer. Electronic stability control, for example, is the safest technology advancement since the seatbelt. So it's really important stuff. So then the third type of driving is fully autonomous with no human in the loop at all. So Waymo, who I advised for over 10 years, has been focused on that type of autonomous driving, fully autonomous, a future in which you could design and engineer cars without steering wheels, without brake pedals, without any driver controls. For me, I think it's a combination of these advanced driver assistance systems. You may have heard brand names like GM Super Cruise or the Tesla Autopilot. And the challenge that we've had with those systems is this instantaneous situation awareness. If you're relaxing because the car is doing a pretty good job of driving itself on the freeway and suddenly something comes up and they want you to take control and you haven't been paying attention, that can be pretty risky. I think where we're headed, because 80 to 85% of the miles traveled in the U.S., the 3 trillion miles traveled in the U.S., are traveled in personal cars with people driving their own car. 87% of the households have a car. So I think when you think about driving your own personal car, so set aside the robo-taxis for a moment, think about driving your own personal car, I think we're going to go into a world where some of the time you'll be on this advanced driver assistance system with humans in the loop, paying attention to take over when needed. And then the other part of the time, you'll be fully autonomous because you can anticipate the road ahead. You know, with data and history and experience and telematics information, weather conditions, that the next 30 miles, the car can drive itself better than you can. So why not let you disconnect? I like to call that a two-mode kind of a driving situation. One more point on this. There's 47,000 miles of interstate in the United States. And this telematics data tells us that the safest stretches of those miles are about one-tenth as risky as the least safe. The data tells us that hard stopping, evasive maneuvers, excessive speed, intense traffic, bad weather, you name it, you can quantify that risk. So why not get going on the safest stretches?
So Larry, when you talked to us back in 2017, you showed us a video of all these little cars that didn't have steering wheels or brakes and that they were running around the city and they were going through intersections with no stop signs because they could all sense each other and just move around each other, just like people when they cross big intersections do. Do you think that that future isn't going to happen? I mean, it sounds like to me what you're saying is that we'll probably always have some human intervention.
I'm not necessarily saying that, Jack. I have written articles and I like to talk about what I see as the mature age of automobility. Now, automobility is the term I use for this intersection between electric vehicles, autonomous vehicles, and connected vehicles. That's what I call automobility. It's the world where I think where we're headed. I'm not going to give you a date. It's always risky to put dates on things. I do think it's inevitable, but I think where we're headed is that we're all going to have a device. Think about it as a mobility device that's analogous to your iPhone as a communications device. That mobility device is going to be our robotic valet, our robotic chauffeur, and it's going to be designed in ways we can't even imagine, just like the iPhone has been designed in ways we never imagined in 1980 or 1990. And this mobility device is going to be electric. It's going to be very low cost per mile. It's going to be extraordinarily safe. And we're going to have dispatch control over our own. I think these are going to be a subscription type of a business model, not a personal ownership type of a business model. And the interesting thing is the real time savings of that kind of a mobility machine are the trips I don't have to take because I can dispatch this machine to go do things for me.
Can you tell us, Larry, who are the leaders in making these devices, as you call them? Like, is it going to come from traditional automakers or is it going to come from the Apples of the world or like, where is it coming from?
I love the question because first of all, I want to take the audience through a little exercise. I'm dating myself. I'm 7. I'll be open about that. But go back to 1980, the 1980s, and think what you had on your desk to do what your iPhone does. You would have had a telephone, a physical telephone. You would have had a flashlight, an alarm clock. You would have had a compass. You would have had a computer and a fax machine. I think you begin to get my picture. There was this enormous pile of things on my desk to do what my iPhone does. So what has really happened here has been a transition from mechanical and electromechanical devices to digital and electronic for sure. But we've had an explosion of design innovation around consumer experiences and integrating functionality into that device. Now think about the supply chain ramifications of the 1980 world where every one of those things on my desk had to be designed, engineered, sourced, tooled. The parts had to be shipped in, it had to be assembled, validated, gotten to the customer, and then serviced after the fact. And all of that's taken out of our system now when we have this iPhone. Now think about that in terms of the automobile, the 100-year-old world of the automobile and everything that we've had in place to make the automobile work. I think it's going to be this design explosion that's going to come on the heels of these technologies converging around different business models. So will it be the auto OEMs? I don't know. Just look at what the Zoox people have come up with the design of their vehicle. Pretty exciting stuff in there. Now that the world sees what's possible, and you take the creative energy, not just of traditional auto design studios, but of all these people in China, all these people in India, all these people throughout Europe and throughout Canada, who have a passion for designing new and innovative experiences around what's now possible. So I can't predict that it's going to be the auto OEMs. I will say this machine that I'm seeing has far fewer parts than a traditional car, far fewer parts. And that has dramatic ramifications for jobs, not just hourly jobs that make the parts and assemble them, but purchasing jobs and engineering jobs and all the other kinds of white-collar jobs in the auto industry. So we're going to see some radical disruption that comes from where all this is headed.
Larry, I want to ask you about truck fleets. You mentioned that there is a shortage of truck drivers, and we're seeing more and more about that. Obviously, what was happening in the UK, but we're seeing reports that this issue also exists in North America. Is it possible that we could get truck fleets autonomous? Because I think there's a real need for it, like right away.
Yeah, I did this book, Autonomy. It came out in August 2018. And if I had a do-over on the book, I would have added a chapter on how I believe autonomous vehicle technology will play out in goods movement commercially faster and at a larger scale than people movement. And here's why. First of all, when you have an autonomous truck, you don't have an occupant in it, so you don't have to do occupant protection. Secondly, trucking has been predominantly a fleet business, so they've always been sensitive to cost per mile. And this future of transportation is going to be all about cost per mile. Third, the truck doesn't necessarily have to always take the fastest route if you don't have a driver in it. If school is letting out at 2:30 in the afternoon, route this autonomous truck far away from the school. Maybe my package arrived on my porch 5 minutes later than it would have, but at least I have the safety of all of that. So there's compelling business case as well. An over-the-road truck driver makes on the order of 75 to 85 cents a mile. And an autonomous driving system with a 500,000-mile life, it's going to be south of 10 cents a mile. So payback is crystal clear here in terms of insurance savings and wage savings. So yes, I think this is going to play out sooner. And then you go back to what I said about the interstate system, focus on the lowest risk. Let's take the first 10% of the miles, 5,000 miles of the interstate, and master that so that we can go from entrance ramp to exit ramp autonomously on those stretches, and we're there. So as this autonomous plays out in the trucking industry, maybe this blended model where there's stretches of the interstate that the driver can sleep, but still is in the vehicle, but they can extend their driving day to 11 or 12 or 13 hours rather than 8. And then they can get back home and things like that. So I think there's enormous potential here, Jackie, on the goods movement. Also, the last mile goods delivery, trying to get the package to me. I think you're going to see these packages delivered to my porch. I think you'll also see them packages delivered to my personal device. If they know where my vehicle is parked, why not drop the package off into that rather than necessarily on my porch? So great opportunities on goods movement.
Maybe I'll just digress for a second, but it's all part of mobility and you're the mobility expert. I mean, like this last mile dropping packages off, we know that the Amazons of the world are already experimenting with drone deliveries and so on. When is it going to be that there's going to be like flight lanes where these things are going to be allowed to be flying over our heads and dropping things off at people's homes?
Certainly, I think safety is going to be the overriding factor in all of these systems. The potential is there to make everything safer than the world we live in today. I mentioned that I advise a real estate developer. It's a company called Kitson & Partners in Southwest Florida, and we're developing an all-new town called Babcock Ranch. We've entered into a relationship with a company called Flytrex, and it's one of two companies in the U.S. today that has approval from the FAA to do small package delivery by drone. So imagine Babcock Ranch is a beautiful community. It has a lot of hiking trails way out into a nature preserve. So let's say one of our residents went on one of those hikes and fell down and twisted their knee, or they were bitten by a snake or something like that. You could send the Flytrex drone out and deliver the anti-venom to those people. Or let's say there's someone on the 8th hole of a golf course who is especially thirsty for a beer, and you can Flytrex out a six-pack. I know these might seem like trivial examples, but this kind of thing is real and it's possible and it's coming. So let's go from the small package delivery by drone to what people like to talk about, flying cars. I think a flying car is a bad car and a bad plane, but I am captivated by the drone type machine that can actually pick me up and carry me somewhere. And I think it's real important to look at the data here. In the United States, 70% of the trips we take are less than 8 miles. I'm not convinced I need to go up in the air for these shorter trips that we take. I think this technology is going to play out initially in a special market segment, sort of the length of the trip and where you can access and where you can be dropped off. So I absolutely believe it's technologically possible. You put the collective imagination and capabilities of the engineers in the world. Engineers make what's possible real, so they're going to make these drones that can carry people real and these flying taxi services real. Is just don't think about that. I'm not implying you and Jackie are, but we shouldn't think about that as a substitute for everything. It's not the be-all, the end-all.
That's great context of the future. Let's come back to today and some of the complications. Some people, I think, are a little less comfortable with even today's autonomous. Are people really wanting this? I'm going to tie it into some of the news that you hear, right? Like Tesla has some negative press that they're crashing into emergency vehicles. And Peter and I both have Teslas now, and I did try out that beta thing, and it kind of made me a little scared. Are people ready to accept this technology?
Well, if people are today accepting driving themselves around in their own cars and the system that we have, and they're accepting 40,000 Americans a year dying on the roads and accepting a 20% increase in that over last year, I think they're going to be thrilled with the safety potential of autonomous vehicles. The design objective isn't to be safer than a human driver. The design objective is to realize airline industry standards of safety. And I think that's absolutely the right goal. I think the objective has to be dramatically safer than human driving. I have become an executive advisor for a company called Neural Propulsion Systems. These are people out of Caltech and quantum physicists and a mathematician who've teamed up. And what they're doing is they're taking multimodal radar, multimodal LIDAR, and they're combining that massive amount of data that you can get by really precisely targeting in a synchronous way everything that's out in front of the vehicles. And then they're using sophisticated mathematical filters to sort of take you from what it would be like seeing with cataracts to now seeing 20/20 vision with eyes in the back of your head. With that said, I think a lot of the consumers who may have hesitation will get relaxed within 3 or 4 minutes of their first ride in one of these autonomous cars. They're that impressive. And you guys play a very important role because you're helping us tell these stories. We got to talk as much, if not more, about what these cars are capable of doing, not what they can't yet do.
I think you said one of your clients is an insurance company. What are the insurance companies thinking about all this? And how does it affect even things like privacy and so on, if I'm monitoring everything I'm driving?
I advised Allstate for a number of years, great company. And they brought me in to help understand connected consumers and to help understand autonomous vehicles. And you probably have heard of the concept of usage-based insurance. This is really insurance where your premium is tied back to you being a safe driver and being able to provide evidence of that by allowing the insurance companies to not monitor you from a privacy standpoint, but monitor your driving behavior so that you can stand out as being a safe driver and get a lower premium. So they're working really, really hard on concepts like usage-based insurance. They're looking at ways of keeping you out of harm's way. So you can say insurance is about giving you financial compensation if something bad happens. Well, isn't it a better deal to make sure you never get in harm's way and something bad doesn't happen? So I think this pivot from insurance to assurance is going to be a really, really important pivot for the insurance companies.
If you have an accident and it's the autonomous vehicle's fault, how is that going to work? Is it the auto company that's going to have to pay? Like, have they thought that through?
First of all, the goal is to have radically fewer crashes. But will there be incidences? Yes, there will, Jack. I think that's fair to say. You know, there's going to be a lot of debate among a lot of lawyers on how to sort that out, because you have people who develop the sensors, you've had people who develop the algorithms, you had the integration of those sensors and algorithms into the vehicle, and then you have company that's branded the vehicle and the transportation service. And so there's all different ways to point a finger at who's going to be responsible. I personally am not a lawyer, but I do think it would be wrong to conclude if I'm riding in an autonomous vehicle and an incident occurs that that was my fault and that I'm liable.
So it seems, Larry, like the hierarchy of priority for autonomous vehicles is, number one, is safety and achieving those airline standards of safety that you talked about. I guess maybe followed by comfort and security within the vehicle. And then bringing it back to my original monologue about energy efficiency at a societal level, if you prioritize safety and all that stuff, does that actually make driving more efficient or not?
I think its safety is at the top of this hierarchy. Then I think you're going to have this explosion of design innovation aimed at lowering the cost as well as enhancing the experience. Now, if we truly can get the crash out of the system, we have an opportunity to get mass out of the machine. And if we can get mass out of the machine, that leads to energy efficiency. So traffic that flows more smoothly is important. And that comes with more confident driving systems and getting the variation of driving out of the system. I was always impressed, John Krafcek, when he was leading Waymo, would talk about, geez, if we have an idea to make our vehicle safer, not only is one vehicle safer, our entire fleet can benefit from that. But with human driving, we don't necessarily have that benefit. If I learn how to be a safer driver, I may not have a way to transfer that knowledge to you or Jack either.
Larry, I have a question. You talked about the fact that you could bring the weight out because if you're never going to hit each other, then the cars could be a lot lighter. They could be like little tin cans, right? But I got thinking about that comment you made earlier about bad weather. We're here up in Canada, right, where we get the snowstorms, the ice. It seems hard for me to think that we'd ever get to that point in certain climates. I can think down in California where the weather is kind of more perfect, you could get there. Is weather going to mean that you can't deploy this in some places?
Well, again, I go back to this company. I'm working with Neural Propulsion System. Those are the exact challenges that we're seeking to address, because we think it's an integrated system of sensors and processors and analytics and software that'll get this job done. So the reason you like radar and LiDAR and cameras, they do well under different conditions. Then you get to the multimodal aspects of these sensors, they can do even better. So we're going absolutely after those challenges. I can't tell you exactly when, but most of the major autonomous vehicle developers are working in winter climates as well, which is very, very encouraging.
I mean, I always like to joke, like we can't even synchronize traffic lights, let alone get into the sort of higher levels of technology. And what role do municipalities and the people that govern these municipalities have to play in terms of accelerating the adoption of this kind of stuff? Because the technology seems to me to be leading the ability to sort of regulate and adopt it into communities.
I'm glad you phrased it in the way of accelerating the technology, Peter, because from my standpoint, the biggest risk we face is not realizing the full safety potential of what we're talking about as soon as we safely can. And so there could have been all kinds of reasons over the last 15 years for regulators to say, hold on, we're not going to let you continue to learn on public roads. And that would have slowed us down. It really would have slowed us down. Unfortunately, certainly in the United States, I can't speak for Canada completely, but in the US, where I'm more familiar, that hasn't happened. Even when we've had some crashes that have involved autonomous vehicles, the reaction wasn't stop everything and stop learning. The only way we're going to realize this full potential as soon as we safely can is to learn as fast as we safely can. And we have to learn on public roads in order to prove out the capabilities that we have. So I applaud the regulators so far at the local, state, and federal level in the U.S. because they haven't taken this approach. And I do think that developers also have to be transparent working with the regulators because they have a very, very important role to play.
This has been a fascinating conversation. You already made some comments. One last question around flying taxis. So if I understand it right, you think it's possible, but you don't think for short distances they're going to take off. But do you think we are going to have them at one point and there will be a use case for
Absolutely.
Them?
Absolutely. I told you I was 70 years old and I think there's going to be use cases for them in my lifetime for sure. It's really, really impressive stuff when you begin to see what's going on. We have to always remember this is not just a developed economy kind of thing. There are so many smart people in the world and creative people and so many people with ambitions to make the world a better place or to benefit from being innovative and creative. And there are things now that are possible that these people are tapping into to deliver amazing experiences for us down the road. So yeah, I have every reason to believe we're going to have these experiences. And the market eventually will sort out where the value sweet spot is. That's very, very exciting. I wish I was 25 again, knowing what I know, certainly, but I would love to see how this is all going to play out. I want to make one last comment, because you started out talking about climate change and what's going on right now in terms of the focus is getting on a worldwide level. In the transportation sector, I don't go to bed at night worrying about carbon dioxide emissions and climate change, because I know technologically the solutions are there. I don't think we have to invent anything to be able to have a future in which we can move people and goods around on our planet and do that in a carbon neutral way. The technology exists. This is about getting the collective will to make the economic changes we have to make to get there. And I'm very encouraged by what's happening when you see major auto companies commit to huge capital investments in electric vehicles and their trends. As they spend their money on electric vehicles, they're not spending it on combustion vehicles. So their portfolios will be electric vehicle based. And then you begin to see the progress we've made on wind and solar. So this is not necessarily calling for new capital, it's calling for the deployment of capital on different solutions. And so I think these problems are absolutely technologically solvable. It's a matter of collective will. And to get that collective will, you got to get the common understanding. And shows like yours help deliver that common understanding. And we'll get there. Now, we got to get there soon enough, because this is one of these problems, climate change. It's nonlinear. And boy, it can really get out of hand in scary ways. But at least I'm not sitting here saying scientifically we need something that maybe isn't possible or maybe we haven't quite figured out yet. I think we've got the toolkits on the transportation side to get that done.
Great. Well, we'll end on that optimistic note. And you're right, the automakers have definitely had a major change in their mindset in the last several years that we've all observed. So thank you so much for coming on our show. We really enjoyed your insights.
My pleasure.
Thanks. Thanks, Larry. Yeah, that's awesome.
Nice seeing both of you.
And thank you to our listeners. If you enjoyed this podcast, please rate us on the app that you listen to and tell someone else about us.
For more ideas and insights, visit arcenergyinstitute.com.